Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Series 2 of Conversations with Annalisa Barbieri. That's me, hello. I'm a broadcaster and journalist, and I write the Ask Annalisa column in The Guardian each Saturday. Every week, when researching the column, I get to speak to some amazing specialists, and this podcast allows me to go into more detail on subjects that come up all the time. I self-fund this podcast, so if you'd like to support us so that we can make more, you can share it widely. If you'd like to make a one-off donation, you can follow the link in the description of this episode, which will take you to the Acast supporter page. And if you'd like to listen ad-free, head over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/Annalisa Barbieri, where you can become a supporter. This episode, about managing differences between people, something we all have to navigate at times, sees me talking to my very first therapist. Psychotherapist Gabrielle Rifkind is the amazing person who sorted me out all those years ago when I was a very young adult. She changed my life. Gabrielle and I have kept in touch, and while she's still a psychotherapist, she's also a mediator and a conflict resolution specialist, often going into war-torn areas to try to reduce tensions between conflict parties. She's worked in the Middle East, Asia, Europe, and is currently back home in the UK. I can't think of a better person to talk about managing differences. She's also the founder and director of the Oxford Process, an organisation which helps to manage radical differences, an author and artist. In this episode, we learn about how, actually, differences between political parties or individuals at home or in families often boil down to the same emotions, how words don't always make it better. And Gabrielle shares a wonderful technique she has used to help smooth out bumps in the road with friends, which is super seductive. Listen out for it. I've used it since she told me about it, and it's amazingly effective. First of all, Gabrielle, I'm really excited to welcome you to my podcast because you were my very first therapist. And I don't expect you to remember our first meeting, but I certainly remember it. I was just out of my teens and you are an art therapist. And I came into your room and you asked me to draw a picture. That was my first foray into therapy. I was just out of my teens and I kind of didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was wrong. And I remember our last session because I remember coming out into the Ladbroke Grove sunshine and thinking, God, I'm the same person, but I feel like I have a different set of tools. Yeah. And I remember that feeling really, really well. So who would have thought all these years later that I would be doing what I do and I would be speaking to you? So that's quite exciting.
That's lovely. Yeah. And it's not just a different set of tools. It's how we think about ourselves, how we've changed the narrative, the story that we tell about ourselves, that we retell it in a way that it looks like sunshine outside.
But you went on to become a conflict resolution expert, and that's what you've been doing for the last 20 years, as well as, you know, lots of other things. But you've worked in some pretty high conflict situations. And I just wondered how, I mean, I think that no matter who you are, at the heart of conflict or differences, and this episode is all about managing differences, are two or more human beings who disagree. Would you say that's right?
Yes. I mean, I think most communications are misunderstandings, often disruptions, and the idea that we would be attuned and understand what the other person means is probably mostly delusional. And that's why we have to work so hard in our communications, because you don't know what's in my mind, I don't know what's in your mind. And what we're trying to do is create a communication so we have more attunement to each other's inner lives, inner worlds.
So when you say delusional, does that...
Yeah.
So what you mean is you don't really know what the other person's thinking.
Yeah.
But you can have an idea, can't you?
Well, we can, but we're often very wrong, because we tend to see the world through our own lens and we project onto the other person what's in our head. And this is both true at the individual level and at the family level, the community level, the psychopolitical level. What took me into conflict resolution is I started my professional life as an art therapist. I then became a group analyst and a psychotherapist. And I then found myself out in the Middle East.
Right. So how do you start to build the trust?
Well, let's assume people have been involved in conflict where people in their families have died, their community, maybe they've killed, that we've been starting an environment of mistrust. And they will treat me with suspicion. It's a process that will take time and involve many, many conversations. And Lisa, you often talk about in your program about the importance of listening, that people will often be full of emotion and not in a place of rational thought or making decisions that are necessary in their self-interest. They might actually be more in a state where they're more interested in hitting back, retribution, making the other side suffer. You know, they want the other side to know how much they have suffered. And I think you have to create a safe space in which people can vent some of these emotions and can feel that they're being properly listened to. And part of that, I think you sometimes say, well, listening's not enough, it's how. And it's important, the how is things like remembering what they say. That's very important. That's about being taken seriously. Being genuinely interested, but never putting into their minds what they think. You have to ask the kind of open-ended question in which you're learning, because often you don't know, and you don't know how someone else feels. We can begin to imagine, but we really have to inquire, and we have to take very seriously what they say and the world in which they're existing.
Some people listening will be in high conflict situations, but really most people are in, you know, a relationship, say, where there's conflict or there's family conflict. So I'd like to sort of think about that. Although what surprises me is how much what you're talking about relates even on a sort of granular level, you know, beyond a war zone. There's often these things can translate to a domestic level. You're sort of saying absolutely about listening and how you listen and showing your vulnerable side. I remember in the past you've said that, really, to sort of overcome differences.
Yes.
But not everyone has you there. So someone listening to this who doesn't have a mediator and they are aggrieved, but they're talking to someone else who's aggrieved.
Yes.
Now, my anecdotal experience is that it's often one person who wants to make things better more than the other. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, very fair. And that's often to do with the unequal power in the relationship. The one who's got more power might not feel they have to do much. And often the weaker party wants to equalise that power. It's very true that it's unusual for both parties to be really to be ready and to do the kind of, to engage in the kind of way that will make a difference. And I often talk about how do you ripen or how do you create the conditions. And I think you're completely right. It doesn't matter whether it's in a war zone or a war zone in the family or in a relationship between a couple or a parent and child. So there's very similar things going on. People feel wounded, they feel humiliated, they often feel very vulnerable. I do believe quite profoundly that it's in the space of vulnerability that we can actually connect and become closer and more intimate. But in the space of vulnerability, people can also abuse it. I mean, it's quite interesting what you thought about that whole notion of vulnerability.
I think it's a really interesting word, because I don't think in society we really talk about showing vulnerability. You know, there's that thing of be kind, be strong, be this.
Yeah.
But it's really all about buffering ourselves against the world, and actually being vulnerable is not something that people aspire to. And you're right. I mean, in some places it's dangerous to show your vulnerability.
Yes.
But I do think if you're trying to manage a difference, overcome a difference and build some sort of common ground. Now, remember, we don't know what these differences could be. They could be a really big difference of opinion on, you know, race or sexuality. So there's various levels. But I think ultimately, a lot of people think it's about being right or wrong.
Yes.
It's not that black and white, is it?
No. I mean, when you think you're right or wrong, that kind of bipolar view of the world, I think we often get very stuck. What you're trying to do is create a space where, I suppose, of some kind of humility. We're not even often that sure what is right or wrong, but we often want to present that certainty because we have a kind of, I say, rather mythological idea that that's actually how it makes the world safe. And what's very difficult is to live in a space of not knowing. But that space of not knowing maybe sometimes offers more creativity, more opportunities, more new ideas. And it's how to make that safe enough so people can tolerate it. I mean, that's certainly one of the things that happened with COVID. We didn't really know what was going to happen, what it means. And governments felt they couldn't show that uncertainty. I think people can be helped to manage that zone, that area of not knowing, and feel safe.
I think it takes a lot of confidence to do that, actually.
I
think paradoxically, to be vulnerable and show uncertainty, you do need some confidence. Back to sort of our mythical couple, be it a romantic couple, a parent and child. So there's differences, there's conflict.
Yeah.
What advice would you give them for how to start the conversation?
But
you won't be there. So what would you say to them? How do you start so they can show humility?
Let's imagine. So we've got this couple. Ever they say, Jay, they just irritate each other more than they both think that they're getting at each other and trying to undermine them. I would say, first of all, never have a conversation like this if you're in the middle of an argument. It's really important that you create an environment when you're not both feeling tense and worked up and angry with the other person. So you might even say to them, look, we're getting stuck at the moment. Let's try and find a more conducive environment. And in my conflict resolution work, we might say something like, why don't we go for a walk in the woods? But in your own family, you know, it might mean people would choose their own thing. Sometimes it's let's go for a meal, or let's have a walk, or let's sit down and watch something. So you want to setting the scene, creating the right conditions. It's a bit like when people come to therapy, that they know that you've created this safe space that you take a great care of, and that, you know, especially protected for them. So you think, what's your version of that? But whatever, bring the temperature down before you try any kind of conversations. I think we all know it. We're very worked up and we often just throw things at the other person and it just winds it up more and more. And in fact, all we know is telling them what we think has made it worse. So I don't think we can assume that words always make it better. It's how we do it. So we try in the first place to make a quite conducive environment. We don't necessarily hit it straight on. Sometimes doing something together in itself can change things. Could be doing some cooking together or sitting down and watching a film or whatever. Just the act of doing something where it's not so tense is an important beginning. And then we have to decide whether we talk about something that's very difficult. I mean, I suppose being a psychotherapist, I'm mostly a fan of finding language, finding words. But I've also learned the importance of being stumm. Psychotherapy gets very carried away thinking that speaking is everything. It's how and when you do it. And it doesn't mean that you have to always share everything. sometimes it's a good idea not to, but actually to be restrained and contain it.
I've learned about the power of silence sometimes, and also time sometimes to think. I have sometimes in my own family said, I need to go away and think about this. And I, especially with my children, I've stressed, you know, I'm not withdrawing my love. I just need to think about this. And sometimes you can let things go. I think, but sometimes if there's a big difference, you do need to. So you set the scene. I totally agree about not having an argument, not discussing when you're in an argument. You know, I think all of those things are really good ideas, as long as both partners agree, of course. I mean, sometimes I hear from people saying, yeah, you know, my partner just won't talk. And we'll come to that in a moment.
Yes.
But so you set the scene, and then how might you start talking that allows them to get to a place of humility and vulnerability, and also allows you to?
I was having some difference with somebody in my own family. What we agreed to do was during lockdown that we would actually have a Zoom conversation. Mm-hmm. And I actually said to them, look, I think it's really important that I listen to you properly. I don't say anything for the first 15, 20 minutes because I could see she was very full of emotion and there were all kinds of things she needed to say. And she needed me to hear her and take her very seriously. And I think that was a very, very important first step. And I think within that, it's very important you don't tell the other person what they think. You don't tell them what's going on in their head, because that usually gets up people's noses and makes them very annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
So you begin by listening very carefully. You might mirror it back to them and see if you've got it accurate. But again, you need to do that very carefully. And you need to say, have I got this right? Or is this something that you want to modify? And because you might well get it wrong, but that's fine as well. So the first act is the listening. And within that is listening to be curious, to be genuinely interested. Later, to remember, because people care about that. And then that what we're talking about is managing very difficult conversations. So this might be around emotional differences, or it might be around ideas, because we live in this very siloed world where people are picking up different information, they're living hermetically sealed lives, just to talking to people who think like them and not crossing the barricade and engaging with people who are different. So that certainly happened on Brexit. You can see it in an extraordinary way between the Democratic and Republican Party in the States. It's very easy to think, if someone thinks differently to you, to feel quite superior.
Mm.
And to think that you're better informed, you're more moral than them. And in some way, you think you're better. And this is a great trap. And dare I say that liberals can get very trapped in a kind of liberal fundamentalism, where we think the other side's ill-educated, hasn't thought about it properly, and that we are superior to them, basically. And I think that's not at all helpful. It's one of the reasons why we have such deep polarization in our society. And quite often, if we do listen, we want to pull the person across the barricade and we want them to then think like us. So we listen, hoping to convince them to think the same as us. And it's really difficult to actually listen and then tolerate somebody's different point of view. So if they don't think the same as me on abortion, I want to convince them. And that's the area where we get very, very stuck.
Why is it difficult? Is it fear?
Yeah, good question. I think we feel safe if people think like us. Maybe it leads us to positions of doubt if people think differently. But we're very caught up in being righteous and thinking we're right. And I think something we miss is that people have such profoundly different experiences. And I sometimes say that a lot of the things people think have been passed on with their mother's milk. And actually what I mean is, I've worked with people, I think right from the time a baby is born, it is taught certain things about the other side that's the enemy. And it's in that relationship at a very early stage that this is what people believe. And it's true on all sides. So what I mean is that is ideas. It's not the milk. The milk's wonderful. It's the ideas that are passed on very early. And therefore, you sort of have to get a sense of where these ideas are coming from. And I mean, there are times when you can't tolerate them. But if you understand, you know, if people have come from religious families, ideas have been passed down with a certain kind of clarity in which they don't even feel able to question things. And sometimes when we get genuinely curious and start listening and get interested, I think what we feel about that difference becomes different.
In what way?
That we perhaps don't feel so intolerant of it. We can understand why someone has something very different, you know, if you understand their personal experience. So it's the sharing of it's going beyond sort of rigid ideological ideas to understanding people's personal stories and why they think in a particular way.
I totally understand that. And I think, again, on a more domestic level, you know, we're often brought up thinking that Auntie so-and-so is not very nice or Uncle so-and-so. And actually, it's only when you grow up and hopefully make your own decision that you think, actually, they're not that bad, but they don't like each other because of something that happened in like 1946. Yes. And I think that, you know, I grew up thinking that Mussolini was a good thing because that's what my mum had taught me. You know, she's told that he made everyone exercise. He sent every child to school and I had to. And it's quite a big deal, isn't it? Going away from what your parents have taught you, because in a way there's a slight rejection of them in doing that.
Well, yes, and we don't really quite realise where our ideas come from and how merged they are and how we just take them on through relationships. And I suppose what we're trying to do is over time is separate from what the ideas people have passed on to us, recognising them, because some of them are rather wonderful, but also working out what our own mind is. And of course, that's what psychotherapy is about. It's also probably a very Western concept, is to work out what do I think, what do I believe, and can I almost stand alone in that and not have to always have it shaped because I want people's love and approval.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think we do curate some of our friendships now on social media. I'm really lucky that my closest friends are from when I was 11.
Wow.
And we do have slightly different views, but we have that kind of common bond. I personally love hearing other people's differing opinions. I mean, it depends obviously what it is. There are some things that are a no-go area for me in terms of, you know, women violence against people.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
If that's what somebody thinks. And I think it's very difficult to find a common ground with sometimes, you know, the differences are just too great.
Yeah.
But we've got our mythical couple and they've started to talk. I mean, can you... At what point are the differences too big that you can't meet in the middle?
Well, it's not that you will always meet in the middle. It's can you bear to manage and tolerate the difference and with a couple keep loving each other and that they might have completely different ways of seeing. I mean, I do a lot of couples work and I always love it because of the energy between people. But I often find, it's really common, I have one couple at the moment, where she wants him to think like her, live a life like her, do things. Basically, she wants him to be some kind of clone of her. Yes. And she doesn't even know she's doing it. And actually, often I think the most healthy relationships is where you can actually tolerate the difference. People often say it's very difficult to have different politics from your partner, or how they want to spend the time might be profoundly different. I think to allow that space for difference can also allow a huge amount of flourishing to take place.
Just generally, how do people get to the place where they can tolerate that difference? Is it about how much they're prepared to put up with?
I think it's partly what they're used to, what kind of world they were brought up in. How much, I mean, I think this is more and more of an issue because with social media, people are just listening to information that is not shared information. It's just to reflect what you already think. And that's what algorithms do. They take you to what you already are expressing your interest in.
I suppose what I would say to people is, where does your point of view come from? And try and trace it back, and how important is it? And how important is the relationship with that person? So, you know, to take a topic that's very hot at the moment, which is about vaccination, you know, I have friends that have a different opinion to me.
Yes.
And they are still my friends. And if we meet and we can talk about it, I'm happy to. I don't want to be lectured to, and I try not to lecture to them. But yes, I try and look at it as a whole, which is this person isn't just the fact that they have their particular stance. But obviously there are some people that have differing opinions that are very different. I mean, we have someone in the family who's really racist and there is no reaching him and there is no listening to him. And I can't reach a place where I tolerate the difference because...
Is that because you've already decided that you're not going to listen to him?
Well, I spent 20 years listening to his misogyny and racism and then I just had enough, really. I just think, I'm never going to change your mind. I think he's wrong and I don't really want to share space with him. So I made that decision a few years ago.
Yes.
And for me, you know, I've made that decision. There's nothing else in it because certain things are just unnegotiable for me.
Yeah, no, I think there are a point where you do say this is intolerable. But I suppose with someone like him, if you've probably done it, if you had a conversation and understood where his ideas came from, would you learn anything new? And would there be any space in which you had a different way of seeing?
Well, every conversation we had, I can see where it comes from, but he's not done the work for me. Do you see? Yeah. It's just about me understanding him. And actually, after a while, it gets a bit tiring. And I just think, no, you know, this is, you have to manage differences. Both people have to want to, and he really doesn't.
Yeah.
So I think there are certain times with certain people you just have to make that decision that there is not enough common ground. You just can't continue the friendship or the relationship. That must be the case where sometimes you just, the difference is just too big, or one person's doing too much work and that's not fair.
Yes. No, I think that's true. You know, there are moments where you have to decide what's acceptable and not acceptable. You might be someone who supports fascism and you think, I'm not going to engage with them. But I think if you can allow yourself to get underneath and understand where people's ideas come from, sometimes you're surprised that something new emerges. And what happens is that you have to manage these very radically different points of view. And it doesn't mean that we'll necessarily find common ground. I think that's the hope we always have, but we might not. We might end up in very, very different positions.
If you can't find any common ground, what do you have? What is the relationship, friendship?
Well, if it's friendship, I mean, I think you always have to decide, am I going to take care of that relationship or is it something I don't want anymore? We have to discriminate in those areas. But, you know, if it's something, someone has a very, very different view on abortion and it comes from a very religious position, and it's very disturbing or troubling to us, it's a real challenge whether we can tolerate that difference. But particularly as if we think it's going to be a threat to us and a threat to how we live our lives, then that becomes very difficult.
What do you mean by threat?
Well, you just need to look at what's happened in Texas and how they're changing the abortion laws. So that means that is a threat to many women as to actually how they live their lives.
When I think about stuff like the abortion laws, I think that's an environment where I won't be listened to as a woman. So I immediately feel threatened. You know, my childbearing years are behind me, but I think, well, this is not a safe place for women. That's my immediate, I immediately go to a threat mode.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the case when we take it, you know, percolate it down. If somebody has a difference to us, we do immediately go to a feeling of threat. And when you feel threatened, you don't feel like finding common ground.
Yeah, I think it's very well put that when we feel threatened, our defences go up. We're not actually open to listening to the other person's point of view. We've often already made up our mind and decided what the other person thinks. And it requires us to relax some of our defences and create a genuinely open environment in which we are able to listen to something that we might not agree with.
Well, it goes back to what you said at the beginning about taking the emotion out of it. Because when you're emotional, you're not rational. You know, the part of your brain that's gone into, you know, your amygdala's on overdrive.
Yes.
Threat. And yeah, you do have to take a step back and think about things and be open. And obviously, hopefully, people listening to this do want to manage differences. So they would create an environment where they both feel safe. And I want to go back to that sort of vulnerability, because I really think that's so important. What is showing vulnerability?
Well, first of all, I think you have to choose. I'm sure we discussed it in the early days. You have to choose who you show your vulnerability to. And you have to decide, will they support me or will they abuse the vulnerability? You know, you can show vulnerability to some people and they'll start just sharing it and they'll be indiscreet about it. And that's not okay. If you share it, and I think you choose people who you're very close to, by showing that vulnerability, then in fact what happens is that's often the space we can become more intimate. Because if the other person is always seen to be strong, we never actually get that close to them. We've always got all our defences up. And it's often when we show that emotion, I mean, I don't know if you've got memories of it, that you realise that the other person's much more responsive, they share some vulnerability about themselves, and you make a step forward into a space of intimacy.
I think it's very important to reiterate the thing about knowing when to show vulnerability, because obviously there are people who will abuse that and who won't meet you on that journey. Is there any way of knowing, is it just experience, who not to show it to?
I think it is. It is. You know, I know my circle. I've got some friends, however much I think they're wonderful, they're indiscreet. Mm. They're not capable of not passing on information. I've got others who I know would be incredibly respectful of the confidentiality and would also use it as part of a loving relationship as opposed to in some way exploiting it. I think you sort of know who you trust in that way and who you don't. Or if I'm just thinking in a partnership where the relationship's in trouble, you might think, how do we build this trust safe enough to share difficult things?
What about if one person is just right, though?
Give me an example.
I don't know. I'm just thinking that I don't know, but I'm just thinking about what about if somebody does something it's someone listening to this and just thinking, yeah, but I'm just right about that argument. I mean, that in itself, I guess you could say you have to look at that.
Yeah.
But if someone's listening thinking, yeah, but I'm just right, what would you say to them?
Well, you might be. But if you're going to communicate that, you're going to create a counter reaction in the other person. And if you've watched, people are often very skilled in this kind of thing. They might start with, I'm not sure if I'm right about this, or this might not make sense to you, what I'm saying. Actually, as a psychotherapist, you have a whole kind of set of things, and it's not contrived, but you might say, I'm not sure you're going to like what I'm going to say. I think you're going to want to throw it away, or this is going to be difficult. So what you're doing is you're setting the scene where you're actually trying to reduce people's defense structure so they're more open to hearing. So you have to just think about the impact you're having on the other person. And if you're absolutely insistent that you're right, you usually create a counterforce in the opposite direction.
What do you mean by that? Sorry.
You know, you tell your partner how they were basically wrong, stupid, insensitive, as opposed to presenting it in a way that they can hear.
Right, I see. I suppose you wouldn't really get anywhere if that's what you did.
Yeah. We do it all the time. You know, you think, how do you... often with children, we try harder. We take more care to present it in a way they can hear it. With partners or people we're really in a rage with, we don't want to do it. We just really want to hit back and not take the care or trouble.
Well, I suppose we want them to know how hurt we are. You know, and that's understandable. But I guess it really comes down to whether you want to move things forward or not.
And also taking ownership of what you feel. So if you say to the other, what you did made me very angry, they're not going to listen. But if you start saying, look, it really hurt when you did this, this is what was very upsetting to me. And then what you're doing is you're taking it back to yourself and you're taking responsibility. When you get into blaming the other person, they stop listening or they hit back at you. And it's really common for us to do that. And actually, change happens when we talk about why it's difficult for us.
When you get to the bottom of, be it, you know, political leaders, people in your therapy room, talking about managing differences, what does it boil down to? Are there particular emotions that you think it's always about that?
Well, let's assume that there's a whole layer of emotions before we've even started around things like humiliation. There might be hatred, there might be disrespect, contempt. And so we need to deal with those emotions to begin with and try and create a different quality of the environment in which people are genuinely trying to look for kinder, softer emotions. You can't underestimate the role of kindness.
And kindness makes people feel safe.
And what kindness often means, I sort of left a pause after that, thinking, oh, where's she going to take me with that question? But what kindness is thinking about the other person and the act of doing that and little gestures around that. So when someone's probably really driven you mad and you're really angry with them and they've exposed you and humiliated you, if you can find a little act of kindness, it's extraordinary in terms of changing the quality of the atmosphere. It's very, very difficult to do. If, for example, you've had a big row and you almost find, you can see the kind of craziness, the irony in it, and then you say, hey, do you want a cup of tea? Let's sit down and try a different kind of conversation. But those little gestures are actually significant in terms of changing the mood.
It goes back to that thing of, you know, in some of the problems I get, it feels like one person's doing all the heavy lifting. And yes. I can imagine them thinking, well, why should I ask him or her for a cup of, you know, would they like a cup of tea? Because they're never meeting me halfway. And then I guess, you know, it goes back to the thing, just you can't make people behave in a different way. So if you have someone and you have differences and they're not doing any of these things, eventually yes. you're going to have to decide whether or not you want them in your life.
But I might challenge you on that. I think it's a bit of a trap to look for symmetry in terms of how much work people are doing. I always say, because in therapy, people always go on about what their partner's not doing and not taking responsibility for. And actually, the only thing we can change is ourselves and our own behaviour. And by doing that, it's quite possible the other person would change as a result of what we do.
True. Yeah?
So we kind of need to give that one a chance.
But I think also sometimes people might think that they're doing all the taking responsibility and changing.
But sometimes the act of us behaving in a way that we like ourselves.
Yeah.
And that we feel more like a grown up in the relationship in itself makes us feel better. So, and sure, we have to decide if we want to be the other person, but we also have to decide whether we'll be happier or more unhappy by not being in the relationship.
Of course, some people haven't got the, well, they have got the choice, but, you know, with family, I suppose it's harder to disassociate, or at least it's not always the end of the irritation. I have a lot of people writing to me saying, you know, can I cut my mum or dad off? And I sort of say, well, you can, but it doesn't mean it's going to be the end of it, really. Going back to what I was asking about, is there a common, like, if you imagine the problems as flowers, if you pull them up, at the root of everything, it strikes me that there's fear, whether it be a political leader or a person in a family. Would you say, I'm asking you, but in terms of the differences, isn't it about fear?
Yes, I think it's possibly about a whole range of emotions, but somehow that's the one that becomes the most magnified. And often fears about not knowing, ignorance, things we've been told, seeing people as threats. I mean, some of it might not be in any way justified. So it's definitely worth unpacking what the fear's about, because the fear is just another defence. You know, the kinds of things that are on in our head. You know, if we're racist, some of our fears about the other person might be, if we actually unpacked it, be to do with the stories we were told. It might be nothing to do with the reality. And so we need to get underneath what the fears are about.
There's somebody that you do want to sustain a friendship or relationship with, but you have got quite radical differences and you feel that you've listened to them. Are there some phrases that you could use to start a conversation which would make them less defensive and more ponderous about where their opinions come from?
Yes. Well, I mean, everything needs tailor-making. And if I'm too prescripted, it won't necessarily apply in your setting. But I suppose if I was having a big difference with a friend, I might say, look, it seems like we keep ending up having some kind of argument about this. And I'm sad because, you know, this is an important friendship for me. I'm just wondering, is it useful if we just listen to each other a bit more and understand what's happening and why you think and I think so differently? Because I want to take care of the friendship. So what you're putting in is something about your valuing something, but then
that's
naming
really
something
seductive,
difficult.
Gabrielle. God, if someone said that to me, I'd just be like, yeah, I just that's really powerful, because actually it becomes less about the difference and more about the friendship.
Yes, more about, and you know, you've said continuously throughout this, there's a point at which you say, I don't want this relationship anymore. And I think we do have to discriminate like that. But if we really care about it and we want to take care of it, I think that the frame we do is the valuing of it and a way of showing our love to that other person.
And what about some good phrases about trying to prompt them to open up about where those feelings come from?
You can say, look, I know we always end up differing about questions like abortion, and I find that quite painful. But I do think I would really like to understand where do your eyes come from? You know, I really want to understand why you think as you do.
I mean, do you think men are better or women are better at managing differences?
Oh, I think that's a brilliant question. You know, it's very paradoxical. I've always thought women are better at friendship because they're better at intimacy. But I think there's another side to it. Men are very good at doing things with friends and often get into less emotional complexity and disruptions. And I think somehow we can learn from each other that we need to be close, and we also need to have boundaries and space sometime.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And also, I think what you were saying earlier about sometimes it's not about the talking. Obviously, it depends what it is, but it's not about the talking. It's about the doing something together or the connection. Because sometimes you can talk things to death.
Oh, yes.
And make no progress. And what you're doing is just borrowing deeper and deeper into a hole.
Yes.
Whereas actually, I mean, I think there's a reason that, you know, on some of those courses, they have these team building exercises, and it's a lot of practical stuff. And I think we used to do far more practical things, maybe a little bit less thinking.
Yes, yes. As a psychotherapist, I'm rather an advocate that sometimes we overtalk things. And that's where we started, you know, the act of doing something like you know, when you started doing art therapy and you said, well, I can't make pictures. But actually, it somehow took the tension out of it. We didn't hit it head on. And you could have your private space as well to think about things.
Gosh, yes. I mean, especially for the person I was, which was just out of my teens, talking. Although I do remember Dr. Stone saying to me, you don't seem to have any trouble talking, but we're closer to what the problem is.
No, I remember that. Yeah, I remember exactly that. And of course, you've always said talking's not enough. It's how you talk and what you do. And I think that you're a great advocate of that. And that's very important.
Well, I think really for me, the biggest thing, I remember once you said to me, and I've carried this, and I might cross-stitch it onto a cushion. You said, you don't want to be right, you want to be understood. And that's actually so true about me, and a lot of people don't get that. They think it's, I want to be right. I don't. I know what I know, but I just want you to understand me. And really, that's what managing differences is all about, isn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. Because actually, when we want to be right, we want to be heard, don't we? We want to be taken seriously. But it can look like you're trying to make the other side weaker and to win. Whereas actually, what you're really looking for desperately is some kind of recognition.
Thanks so much to Gabrielle for that. Her artist website is linked in the episode description. Her book describing her conflict resolution work is called The Fog of Peace, How to Prevent War, and is published by Bloomsbury. What I learned from this conversation is how important it is to show vulnerability if you want to build bridges with someone. Appropriate vulnerability, i.e. where you can trust the other person, can be an effective antidote to someone else's fear, which I think is the basis of all conflict. The series is produced by Hester Kent, the music is by Toby Dunham, and our artwork is by Lo Cole. Follow us on social media, on Instagram, @PocketAnnalisa. You can read my Ask Annalisa Barbieri column in The Guardian magazine every Saturday. And we'd love to hear your suggestions for topics you'd like us to discuss on future podcasts. Please email us at conversationswithannalisa@gmail.com. If you enjoyed and benefited from today's episode, do please share it with someone else you think might find it useful. And it would mean a lot to us if you could give us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening, and do join us again.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, this is Annalisa. I started doing this podcast because it's an idea I really believe in, so much so that I decided to put my money where my mouth is and self-fund the project. I really want to keep releasing this podcast for free, so if you enjoy this episode, a way you can help is to visit our Acast supporter page and give what you can. You'll find the link in the episode description. Thank you.